Before we start this episode, I want to try an experiment. Close your eyes and imagine your hometown. Now try to imagine it from a bird's eye view. While you're still imagining it from above, I want you to think about that one forbidden place. That spooky haunted house. The park you never went in after dark. That one part of your hometown that somehow became an urban legend. I want you now to zoom in with your imagination and put yourself there. My name is Josh, and this is Obscure History. Isn't it funny how a place can take on a life of its own? Inanimate steel and wood and dirt somehow can absorb our human traits and become legendary. I grew up in a small town in eastern Oregon, and in our small town there was a particular park that was the scene of a grisly murder in the 1980s. One summer night, a man and a woman got into a drunken argument in a bar. The two left separately, but the next morning, a family found the mutilated body of the woman in the park. Rumors circulated, people panicked. The police made an arrest swiftly. Though the investigation was over rather quickly, the memory of that crime permeated the soil of that park, and the swing set and merry-go-round adopted that trauma. A couple decades later, it was still known as Hatchet Park, and rumors of ghostly figures moving in the night were a natural part of our cultural zeitgeist. According to legend, the spirit of the slain woman would push children off the merry-go-round and swing on the swing set on windless days. Everybody that grew up in that small town probably has a story about that park, myself included. When I was young, I met my therapist at that park. We would play basketball or sit on the swings and talk. At one session, however, I wanted to spin on the merry-go-round, and as I spun in slow circles, I somehow found myself propelled off the ride, only to be trapped underneath it momentarily. Luckily, my therapist was able to pull me out before any real damage could be done. Now, I didn't think anything of this incident until I was much older and discovered that this is a very common experience in this park. I still don't believe in ghosts, but I do think it's interesting that the merry-go-round had been removed before I moved away. Logically, it was probably just poorly balanced or outdated or slippery, but regardless of the actual cause, these incidents bolstered the legend. There are places like this everywhere. One of the oldest tropes in the long tradition of urban legends is the discovery of Native American burial grounds. These tropes are generally problematic as they tend to ignore actual anthropological and historical fact in exchange for sensationalized hocus-pocus. One great example of this is the Amityville horror story. To summarize, a family moves into a haunted house, the dad gets possessed by an evil spirit, and their lives go to all hell. These strange happenings get blamed on the fact that the house was built near Native American burial grounds. It unfairly imposes some sort of malicious intent on people who are long dead. Even worse, the fascination with Native American burial grounds extends beyond the realms of urban legend and worked its way into actual archaeological studies. For many years, archaeologists, motivated by the promise of information or treasure, have exploited indigenous cultural sites without permission. Human remains and other cultural items have been excavated and used for research and museum exhibitions, oftentimes without consultation from the tribes affected by those choices. It's an added insult to the tragedy of genocide that our nation's native people have already endured. Despite being somewhat problematic, there is a good reason why the Native American burial ground trope persists. There are areas of our nation that have been built atop the remains of former civilizations. In our cultural imagination, there is always the chance of finding some artifact of a long-gone society in the most mundane of places. It's sort of convenient to think that Native people were in small, loosely related groups that were wholly independent, but that's simply not true. About 2 hours south of Decatur, Illinois, is a city called Collinsville. It's built upon fertile soil, but furthermore, it's built over top one of North America's greatest pre-Columbian cities. Author Lee Bay of the Guardian's Lost Cities series notes that In its prime, about 4 centuries before Columbus stumbled into the Western Hemisphere, Cahokia was a prosperous pre-American city with a population similar to London's. Located in southern Illinois, 8 miles from present-day St. Louis, it was probably the largest North American city north of Mexico at that time. It had been built by the Mississippians, a group of Native Americans who occupied much of the present-day southeastern United States from the Mississippi River to the shores of the Atlantic. Cahokia was a sophisticated and cosmopolitan city for its time, yet its history is virtually unknown by most Americans. It is one of the many stories that have been bypassed in favor of the simplistic narrative of Native Americans as backwards and primitive, which has been reinforced by various forms of media and lazy history in the centuries since. Some estimates suggest that the population of Cahokia was nearly 40,000 at its peak. The city was well organized into quadrants with plazas, community centers, ceremonial mounds, and workshops that produced highly delicate and advanced copperwork. Sadly, environmental changes and a couple of very significant floods forced the people of Cahokia to resettle elsewhere in the Midwest, and eventually the once bustling metropolis would be reclaimed by the earth, tucked under a soft blanket of dirt and grass, and even later still it would be built over top of by foreign settlers. The memories left in that place weren't malicious, nor did they have the power to possess those who came later. But there is something to be said about stacking history atop history. Many times, legends are thrust upon places like this, even more so than a place that suffers only one present tragedy. Hell Hollow is one such place. From their book Weird Illinois, Troy Taylor, Mark Moran, and Mark Skewerman write, "The first home built by a settler near Decatur was a log cabin erected in 1820 by William Downing, a fur trapper and honey gatherer. More frontiersmen began to arrive from the east, and by 1829 the village of Decatur was platted. It was named after the naval hero Stephen Decatur, who had been noted for his spectacular feats of bravery during the wars with the Barbary pirates in the early 1800s. The hardships and trials of early life in Decatur were much like those in other frontier settlements. Most of the settlers lived outside the village in log cabins, in the forest, and along the river. Many died from the bitter cold and fierce storms of the winter of 1830 and 31. But that winter also gave birth to one of the greatest legends of the Decatur area. A legend of death, depravity, and cannibalism in a place known today as Hell Hollow. According to the legend, the wooded site that would someday be Hell Hollow was once the location of a small settlement. It was the most secluded of the outposts surrounding the village of Decatur and was in an area that was mostly avoided by the local settlers. They came here only to bury the dead. The hills above this narrow valley were part of an Indian burial ground that was soon taken over by settlers. In later years, it would become Greenwood Cemetery. During that bitter winter, snow seemed to fall constantly, alternating with sleet and ice, and it reached heights of 3 or 4 feet. The tiny collection of cabins was cut off from the rest of the settlers in the area. Food became scarce, and as the cold months wore on, the deer, turkey, squirrels, and prairie chickens all but disappeared, as the settlers hunted all the game they could find. Soon, stores of flour and dried meat were depleted. The outlook was grim, and there was a good chance that the settlers would starve to death long before spring arrived. They made do with what they had, boiling tree bark into a bitter soup and even eating shoe leather and rawhide to stay alive. Finally, they had no option but to turn to the only food supply that was available: each other. In the early months of winter, one of the older members in the community had passed away and the body had been stored in an outbuilding, awaiting burial when the ground thawed. This was the first of 2 corpses that the settlers were forced to eat that winter. When the weather finally broke, the remains of the devoured bodies were secretly buried on the hill, and the cannibals were sworn to secrecy. After a few months, someone discovered the horrible secret. The settlers vanished from the area and were never heard from again. While this may have been one of the first bizarre events to take place in Hell Hollow, it was most definitely not the last. At some point in the late 1800s, the hollow became the territory of a gang called, for some unknown reason, the Biscuit Necks by the local populace. They specialized in extortion and robbery and used the woods south of the cemetery as their base of operations. Then they committed a particularly vicious crime, thought today to be the robbery of a store during which the owner was killed. When local authorities failed to find them, a vigilante group took up the case and soon discovered their base. They captured the men and hanged them on the spot. As a message to other criminals operating in the area, the vigilantes left the bodies of the Biscuit Necks hanging there in Hell Hollow, swaying in the wind, until the elements and vultures finished off the corpses. So it's clear that Hell Hollow had a very troubled history, but things only got more depraved from there. But before we continue, let's pause for about 90 seconds for an ad break. Hang tight, when we get back, we will make our way through the twisted history of Hell Hollow. Now, the Biscuit Necks weren't the only gang to call Hell Hollow home. About a century after the Biscuit Bandits used Hell Hollow as their base of operations, newspapers began running a very intriguing story. Fix 8 killings on terror gang. Grave robbing, vice, and alcohol are laid to odd cult. Decatur, Illinois. An amazing terror cult was uncovered here today in the Hell Hollow River bottom south of the city by agents investigating a series of 8 mysterious, unsolved killings during the last few years. Boastfully calling themselves the Hounds of Hell Hollow and embracing remnants of the once powerful Egan's Rats gang of St. Louis and the Burger Gang of Heron, Illinois, the ruthless desperados virtually ruled one end of this city of 58,000 inhabitants, authorities declare. Recognizing no law but the code of silence and enforcing their edicts with a shotgun and whipping post, they swept through the lowlands in a wave of plunder and vengeance. More than one of their victims, according to investigators, went to their death at the behest of a mysterious crystal gazer who attended secret meetings in the dead of night under an old elm tree in the lonely Greenwood Cemetery. While investigators believe many more killings may eventually be traced to the terror cult, these have definitely been laid at its door by authorities. Everett Barker, 15, son of John Barker, lured from his home and shot in the back of the head at 5 a.m. November 26, 1929. He had overheard a plot to slay his father for a $10,000 life insurance policy and a $700 bank account. Melbourne Savage, 39, head groundskeeper at Greenwood Cemetery, whose shot-riddled body was found sprawled over a gravestone near the gang's midnight rendezvous on the burial ground. Walter B. Shire, 38, operator of a gun and sporting goods store, died mysteriously 6 months after the Barker boy's bleeding body was found a few feet from his front door. Evidence discovered recently indicates that he was poisoned. His body is to be exhumed. Roy Polin, alleged alky cooker and grave robber who disappeared February 1st, 1933. His body, with battered skull, was taken from the river June 11th, 1933. Gladys Walton, 15-year-old honor student at rural Elm Grove School, 2 miles southeast of Hell Hollow, whose battered body was stuffed into a closet of her parents' farm home. She died in St. Mary's Hospital the next day, May 25th, 1934. Joseph Bersano, 34, miner and cult member, blackjacked to death a few miles from his home. Mrs. Sadie Sunderlich, 45, wife of Stanley Sunderlich, who occupied the second of 3 cabins, including Persano's. She was killed by a shotgun blast as she answered a knock at the cabin door at about 9 o'clock at night, August 24th, 1935. Guy Mulligan, 45, occupant of the third cabin in the group, was witness to Mrs. Sunderlich's slaying. He was virtually decapitated by 2 shotgun charges fired through his window the night of November 16th, 1935, as he played an old reed organ. Victor Rossetto, 35, husband of Mrs. Sunderlich's eldest daughter, Grace Francis, and alleged cult member. He died in St. Mary's Hospital apparently from an appendix operation. Recently acquired evidence, however, led investigators to plan to exhume his body and search for poisons. Authorities said today that they had renewed their investigation of the mysterious killings after a recent grand jury probing the murders, grave robberies, white slavery, and other vice conditions failed to uncover any real criminal or major offender. Now, those are certainly some alarming claims, and they caught on like wildfire. In 1936, Midwest papers were flooded with the story of the Hounds of Hell Hollow, a satanic terror cult responsible for every unsolved murder and misdeed committed by the people of Decatur, Illinois. But even beyond those claims, even more riveting testimony came forward. Rendezvous of Hell Hollow Hounds found. Robert M. Parks, staff correspondent of the Chicago Herald Examiner, who has been revealing in a series of articles the workings of a mysterious cult that thrives in crime, commits murders, and entices young girls to live lives of shame without getting any attention from law enforcement officers, continues his investigation. Following are excerpts from their terror story. Decatur, Illinois. In a dismal ravine of secluded Greenwood Cemetery, investigators have discovered the secret midnight rendezvous of the mysterious Hounds of Hell Hollow. It was here, they said, among the eerie shadows of gravestones, that the ruthless terror cult plotted at least 8 unsolved murders, floggings, white slavery captures, and grave robberies which shocked the city. It was over a nearby tombstone that the bullet-riddled body of Melbourne Savage, 83, foreman of the cemetery groundskeepers, who boasted former gang connections in St. Louis, was found grotesquely sprawled after flouting the dictums of the cult. Shortly before he was slain, Savage told his landlady, Mrs. Stella Holtz, "They're bad boys, Stella, but I'm in with 'em, and can't get out. They'd just as soon kill me as anyone else." Mrs. Holtz told investigators, "Sometimes when I had been down to the river at night and walked across the cemetery, I could see the black shadows of men moving weirdly among the tombstones. I knew they wouldn't hesitate to kill me if they saw me. They always shot spies." Melbourne wasn't the leader of the gang. No one seemed to know who just was the brains, but somebody downtown, someone with political influence. That's why no one in the river bottoms was ever arrested for all those murders, even after the state's attorney, police chief, and mayor were indicted and removed from office. Meanwhile, charges of political corruption were hurled by Reverend Homer E. Sala, anti-crime crusader and pastor of the First Christian Church. He was the foreman of the special Macon County grand jury that indicted the 3 officials last January. In a 2.5-page article in the Christian Standard published shortly after the jury recessed, Reverend Sala said, "Flagrant and open violation of law in any community does not come on a day or a brief period of time. The situation has been growing here for years. During this time, even the church has been acquiescent, and church people have been consumed in material things. The encroachment of vice got so close to the higher interests that it had produced almost a complete circle of houses of prostitution about our high school, and many otherwise legitimate places of business had become open vendors of quantities of the most obscene literature published." Dr. Sala made it plain in discussing the jury's activities that it had been not directed to investigate the unsolved killings and other atrocities in the river bottoms. "Our instructions from Circuit Court Judge C.Y. Miller were to ferret out vice and gambling in the city," the minister explained, and continued, "but throughout almost 6 weeks of hearings, reference to the killings in the hollow was made by one witness after another. The existence of gambling and vice was common knowledge, and the grand jury sought to determine not merely who were the persons engaged in the operating resorts, but the reason why they were allowed to operate." Fear gripped the greater Decatur area and the Midwest at large in the days following this publication. Lawyers launched probes into the unsolved crimes. When they were informed that there wasn't enough evidence to charge anybody in the crimes and that law enforcement didn't even know the identity of any of the hounds, the lawyers threatened to take the case to the Supreme Court, accusing the police of being a part of the bloodshed. However, there would be no case filed with the Supreme Court. There wouldn't even be a case filed in the local courts, because only a few days after these publications, the Decatur Herald set the record straight. September 14th, 1936, merely a handful of days after those initial publications. Faked cult story amuses city. Hearst paper rewrites unsolved murders into Hell Hollow thriller. Decatur is represented as a hideout for gangsters and a headquarters for a mysterious terror cult in a sensational story published Sunday in a special edition of the Chicago Hearst paper. Stringing together the stories of some unrelated crimes over a period of 7 years, and embroidering the fabric with a tissue of imagination, the Hearst reporter, who represented himself in the city as a federal G-man, presented a dime novel thriller for the amusement of readers. Decatur authorities said last night there is no basis for the claim and branded the story a fake. Dates of the unsolved murders and names of the persons suspected of the crimes were secured by a reporter for the Hearst paper from files of the Herd and Review. Roby M. Parks came to the office of the Herald and Review on Friday, September 4th, representing himself as an investigator for a group of insurance companies interested in learning whether an element of insurance fraud existed in any of the deaths in Decatur. Upon that representation, he was permitted access to the Herald and Review library files. Upon the same day, Mr. Parks visited the office of Ivan J. Hutchins, acting state's attorney, and represented himself as a newspaper reporter employed by a Hearst news service. He suggested to Mr. Hutchins that he could be helpful in solving murders of recent years, but asked that exclusive publication rights upon any developments be given to him for first publication in Chicago. Mr. Hutchins refused to enter into the arrangement, explaining that painstaking investigations are being carried on regarding all unsolved crimes. Mr. Hutchins conferred with other Macon County authorities, and all agreed that the customary type of Hearst paper news stories would be more harmful than helpful. From the data obtained from the Herald and Review files, the Hearst reporter fabricated the first of a series of stories about a terror cult, which he said operates in Hell Hollow, described by him as a section of the Sangamon Riverbank below Greenwood Cemetery. Hell Hollow was a new name so far as Decatur residents are concerned. Much of the Sangamon Riverbank is open to view and runs parallel with the Lakeshore Drive. The small area south of the Greenwood Cemetery, which several years ago was familiarly called the Jungle as a result of the hobos gathering there to cook their stews, was cleaned of its dense growth of underbrush long before many of the murders mentioned in the Chicago news story occurred. The Hearst reporter apparently made no inspection trip of the riverbanks before writing his colorful story. The imaginative author of the story spoke of the odor of the marsh being cooked by illicit alcohol stills that could be detected occasionally at night in Decatur. A little investigation might have convinced him that he was experiencing the pungent odor that all Decatur persons know result from the processing grain in the A.E. Staley Company plant. The Hearst paper's effort to connect unsolved murders in the community with official corruption was equally grotesque. The indictment last January of State's Attorney Arthur O. Frazier, former Mayor Harry Barber, and former Chief of Police Jack Cooper had no connection with the murder cases. All three officials were indicted as a result of grand jury investigation of gambling and commercial vice in the community. The reporter's idea that the grand jurors knew of the terror cult but were unable to make investigations because they were on a special grand jury is in error. The investigation was made by a regular grand jury, which makes a complete investigation of all crime and made its general report before it launched its probe of gambling and vice. Another grand jury since has convened and adjourned without receiving any evidence substantiating the Hearst paper's claims. Impersonating himself as a G-man, Roby Parks, the Chicago newspaper reporter, went through the south side of town working up the residents of that section to obtain material for his story, purporting to show that 8 unsolved crimes in Decatur were the work of a terrorist cult, Decatur and Macon County authorities said Sunday night. Parks was positively identified through the license number on his car as the man who went to the home of Mrs. Leo Cox, formerly Rosetta Sunderlick, posing as a federal agent. Parks finally talked with Mrs. Cox's 10-year-old sister and gave her 25 cents to get him a picture of Mrs. Sunderlick. Parks took the girl in his car to Mrs. Cox's home where he was given the picture, according to information given to Sheriff Emery Thornell and Acting State's Attorney Ivan J. Hutchins. Reverend Homer E. Sala, chairman of the grand jury that indicted the officers, said, "None of the murders mentioned in the faked story were considered by the grand jury, nor was there any connection between any of them in the facts upon which the grand jury based its indictments. I was mosquitoed by the reporter. The only statement I made to him was that before the recent grand jury investigation, gambling and vice conditions in Decatur were recognized as wide open, and that it was a condition accepted by the public. The suggestion that there could be any connection between those murders and local officials in any way is foolish, I so informed the reporter. So that's it. The whole story was faked by a couple of reporters to boost circulation for their paper. Perhaps, at the very most, the increase in murders is indicative of old gangs returning to the area, rather than a new satanic cult setting up shop in the woods outside of Decatur. Seems pretty cut and dry, doesn't it? Not exactly. You see, once an urban legend is born, it's nearly impossible to kill. The hounds of Hell Hollow pop up in news stories sporadically throughout the 1930s, and far beyond. April 10, 1937. Hell's Hollow citizen fires into tavern crowd. Hounds of Hell Hollow, previously believed a fantasy of Chicago newspapermen, was given some credence last night when Charles Lorton was arrested for firing 4 shots into the midst of a crowd of Southside Tavern patrons. He gave his address to the police as Hell's Hollow. About a dozen customers of the Mug Tavern, 1081 South Franklin Street, were drinking at the bar at about 9 p.m. last night when 4 revolver shots rang out from across the street. The bullets pierced the plate glass front and scattered among the customers who fell to the floor and hid behind chairs. A squad car was called at once and Lorton, 60, a WPA worker, was brought to headquarters. When the desk sergeant asked his address, he answered 1041 South Main Street. Otherwise, Hell's Hollow. Mrs. Laura Hollenbeck, owner of the tavern, signed a warrant before Justice H.F. Payne, charging Lorton with malicious destruction of property. Police found him in possession of a Spanish-made revolver containing 4 empty cartridges and 1 unused shell. He had been in the tavern earlier in the evening and we wouldn't sell him any more liquor, Mrs. Hollenbeck said. I saw the gun in his pocket then. Where the bullets fell, police were unable to learn, but the customers declared that they were missed by inches. Donald Martin, bartender, is believed to have been most directly in the line of fire. He dived behind the counter. Neighbors said Lorton stood in an alley about 100 feet from the tavern when he fired the shots. He was arrested in his Hell's Hollow residence. Despite a mountain of evidence that proved the Hell's Hollow legend was complete fiction, it's individual stories like these that kept reminding the public of it, and it eventually burned its way into becoming some sort of loose cultural fact. To illustrate this phenomenon, here's a paragraph from an amazing article that was written 30 years after the initial story ran. March 10th, 1969. Absurd or not, boundless proof may there be. There are still those who are not thoroughly convinced that at least part of the story is not valid. Some of the Decatur residents who recall details of the unusual story still cast their opinions when it becomes the subject of occasional conversation. This is a great example of how legend can become fact when reported on enough times and passed through enough generations. I'm sure that there are those who still believe in the Hounds of Hell's Hollow today, despite the overwhelming evidence that disproves their existence. There's something else to consider, though. Why did those reporters fake the story in the first place? Were they just that desperate to get their names out there? Actually, the answer to this is shockingly complex and involves millionaire businessmen, billion-dollar companies, shady back-alley dealings, and brutal violence which would eventually give birth to the Chicago Mafia Wars that would give us some of the most dangerous criminals in American history. But that's a story for another day. Join me next week as I explore how the completely fabricated story of the Hounds of Hell's Hollow eventually led to some of the most terrible and true crime our nation has ever seen. All right, guys, thank you so much for listening today. I appreciate all of you so much. Before I get too far here, I do want to let you know that today's episode was sponsored in part by Earbuds Podcast Collective and the Indie Drop-In Network. These are 2 amazing services that can help you find new podcasts to listen to of all shapes, sizes, and genres. I love these services, and I can tell you from personal experience, they are owned and operated by a couple of the best people in the podcast game, so definitely check them out if you're looking for something new. I also want to remind you that you can write in at obscurehistorypod@gmail.com. You can find us on Twitter or Instagram. I say us, it's just me. If you DM me on any of the social medias, I will DM you back because this is still a one-man show. So if you want to like see some fun news about the show that I don't always mention in the episodes, or maybe some poorly constructed memes, definitely find it at All the People Pod on Twitter because it won't let you change your username, at Obscure History Podcast on Instagram because Instagram does let you change your username, and one final reminder that if you go to obscurehistorypod.com, you can find a link to the merch store. Every time you make a purchase there, a portion of that purchase goes to support UNICEF because the world should be full of happy kids and not kids that are struggling with hunger and basic safety needs. All right, and taking us out this week is Fairhazel, once again, with his song Below. I really, really dig this track. It's got kind of a super cool, like maybe 1970s throwback vibe. It's definitely going on my playlist of good vibey, kind of like sunny day songs. I hope you guys enjoy it. A link to his stuff is going to be in the show notes, just like with Earbuds Podcast Collective and the Indie Drop-In Network. It is currently an hour past my bedtime, so I need to go or I will die. Okay, have a nice week.
Broke a heart on a Tuesday, wrote a song on a Wednesday, money's gone. Well, by Thursday, and by Friday, she's the fool. Tore a hole in her pillow for her screaming lungs to bellow. Wore them out, broke them in. Been spoiled.